Welcome back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian. Some stats on energy usage compiled by the International Energy Agency. The world's primary energy demand grows by 1.6% per year on average, and between 2006 and 2030, the world will experience an increase of energy demand by 45%. China and India account for more than half of the incremental energy demand to 2030, while the Middle East emerges as a major new demand center. Both countries' energy use is set to more than double by 2030. The demand for oil will rise from 85 million barrels per day now to 106 million barrels per day in 2030. Demand for coal rises more than any other fuel in absolute terms, accounting for more than a third of the increase in energy use. Modern renewable energy sources will grow most rapidly, overtaking gas to become the second largest source of electricity soon after 2010. Who turns out the lights? Those who want the U.S. to act decisively on climate change seem to be losing the battle of public opinion lately. Only 30% of Americans say global warming should be a top priority for Congress and the President. That's behind the economy, terrorism, Social Security, healthcare, immigration, and even that most tedious of all issues, trade policy.
Yeah, when the lights are out, down in this dirty little town.
Most consumers said that their energy bills would need to rise 70% before they would feel forced to make energy efficient improvements to their homes. Who turned out the lights? A new book from Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson involves one major theme. We need to find ways to balance the Earth's natural resources with the growing demand for energy. Since our fragile atmosphere, too, is a natural resource, our balancing act must not destroy it.
The laws of nature say you get nothing for free, and love is like stealing electricity.
Americans represent 5% of the world's population. Yet, with our way of life, we are using 22% of the world's energy. So, no matter how you measure it, there is indeed a crisis. Nathan Lewis, a Caltech professor, states that since today's energy decisions take 20 years to begin to flow, there is no tomorrow, because by that time, whatever decisions we've made today will be cast in stone.
Mr. Faulkner, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me in, and a very good evening.
I wonder if I could ask you about the environment.
Yes, that's not a bad idea, although I'd get right on with it if I were you.
What's the hurry?
Well, nothing in particular, it's just that I've got a few other things to do.
Well, what have you got to do?
I've got to go and address the Australian Business Council about this...
Environmental crisis?
Yes, we're going to have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in this country.
How much do we produce?
And I'm the poor mug who's saddled with the job of explaining this to industry.
And how are you going to do that?
Well, I'll order them to do it if necessary.
I'll get tough with them.
I'll introduce legislation, yes. This is a non-negotiable commitment we have made. We have said we will do this and we will do it.
Do it, yeah. What are our greenhouse emissions at the moment?
Well, we don't produce a great amount of greenhouse gas in this country at all.
Yeah, well, how much?
And, of course, we'd like to get that figure down. We'd like to reduce that figure and get it down.
Mr. Faulkner, what is...
Figure down.
Yeah, but what is it?
At the moment?
Yeah.
350 million tonnes.
What, in a year?
No, this is annually.
Well, what are we going to get it down to?
349 million tonnes.
Really? And we think this is achievable?
We think that is a sustainable aim, yes.
By when?
By the year 8,000,004. Well,
Gene Johnson, co-author with Scott Biddle of Who Turned Out the Lights, is the Director of Education Insights and Director of Programs at Public Agenda. Johnson has written articles for USA Today, Education Week, and the Huffington Post. She has appeared on CNN, The Today Show, Lou Dobbs Tonight, and The O'Reilly Factor, among others.
We're speaking with Gene Johnson, the author of Who Turned Out the Lights. So why don't Americans really focus on the issues around global warming and our over-reliance on fossil fuels?
Well, Well, I think that, you know, there are a couple of reasons. You know, one is that a lot of us are very used to getting all the energy we want by flipping on the switch. We've had relatively low gas prices here and been able to get as much of that as we want. Global warming seems like it's very, very far off. When people hear, you know, predictions that temperatures might rise, you know, 5 or 6 degrees, people think, oh, gee, what is that? And, you know, they don't really understand that there are, in fact, a couple of very serious threats. One is that, you know, 5, 6 degrees of temperature can cause devastation in terms of the climate, in terms of flooding, in terms of changing how agriculture works. And, you know, I think that a lot of Americans don't tend to understand how serious that would be in terms of the economic disruption of it and how irretrievable it would be. And I think on the other side, it's not just global warming. There are the world is going to need a lot more energy. And the projections are that we're going to need 5 times as much electricity as we have now. You know, we're all using all these gadgets. And the fuels that we rely on, the fossil fuels, are not here forever. So we're facing both the danger of climate change and the danger of having to compete with China and India and people around the world for ever scarcer supplies of oil and other kinds of energy.
Along those lines, with this demand growing exponentially out over the next few years, is it true that we're really at a point of peak production for oil? Are we the remaining reserves are going to be more difficult to get to and more costly, obviously?
Yeah, you can get the experts can go back and forth and back and forth on exactly when the peak is, and that's that's the point at which we've gotten the most oil, and after that it begins to decline. I think what is very clear is that most experts agree that we have gotten the oil that is cheap and easy to get to. And, you know, now we're talking about drilling in the ocean and getting it from tar sands in Canada and all these other options. We're going to get more oil. We're going to need more oil. But the real crunch and the real, I think, the thing that people need to consider is that more and more people want that. And one of the statistics that we use in the book is that, you know, China's growing, its middle class is growing, and they're beginning to want to live the way that we do. And historically, Chinese families haven't had a family car or several the way a lot of American families do. You know, and if they begin to own and drive cars at the rate Americans do, it would be 1 billion more cars on Earth. So not only would that be terrible for global warming emissions, think what it would do for the price of oil. And there's only so much of it. We really need to diversify our energy supply.
What is the tipping point on the cost of a barrel of oil when it really starts to change our quality of life? Because some would say that, you know, cheap oil has really pushed the trend toward globalization. It's accommodated the fact that we've become so globalized. But at some point in time, that cost of oil is going to go up to a point where really you've got to live more locally, probably.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, I think that this country and its economy, we have benefited from cheap energy. There's no doubt about it. And I think that, I think it's an unfortunate truth that whether we plan it so we can rethink how we get our energy or whether we just sit back and wait to let it happen to us, energy is going to be more expensive. There's only so much of it. More people want it. It's sort of a recipe. And if you think just a year ago, it seems like it was longer than that. A year ago, oil was hitting $135-ish a barrel, and gas was up to $4. And, you know, there was a virtual, we were throwing up all these kind of panicky solutions. Let's sue OPEC. I mean, we get into this we go crazy when gas goes up. I think what has happened historically is we tend to get all upset when gas prices go up. And when they drop again, which, you know, these are prices that go up and down all the time, we tend to kind of let go of all the resolutions we've made about how we're going to, you know, change the way we drive and get really serious about energy efficiency and start getting different kinds of energy available to us. And, the projections are that when the world economy begins to recover, prices are going to start going up again, and we ought to get ready for it.
Do you think nuclear power is a viable alternative for us in the United States?
Well, you know, one of the things that we point out in the book, and we actually try to go through, oil, natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, all the various options, you know, they all have pros and cons. And I think it's just we're kind of kidding ourselves to think that there's a kind of a perfect solution. So we like to point out the pros and cons. You know, one of the things I think a lot of Americans don't realize is we already get almost a fifth of our electricity from nuclear power. So we're already using it to a certain degree. You know, the big advantage of nuclear power is that it does not contribute to global warming. A lot of people don't know that. But if you look at the big chart, nuclear power is down there with wind energy in terms of being a clean form of energy. The downside is that they have never figured out what to do with the waste in any way that everybody's happy with. So you do have this nuclear waste left over. It's worrisome. You have to be very, very careful with it. And, you know, I think it is a technology that a lot of Americans are not comfortable with. It is expensive to build a nuclear plant. You know, it's a big thing, so you want it to, you know, it has to be strong, and then you want them to be careful and do all the studies. And there's also a huge kind of regulatory process. Often there's a lot of delays with hearings, so it's very expensive to build it. Once it starts, the energy is actually not that expensive. So it is definitely, it's kind of the poster child for a form of energy that has pros and cons. But, I think it probably deserves a new look.
But then, of course, we have the specter of Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, which affects people's view of it. Right?
It does. And, we kind of went back to review them for the book, and I learned a lot. I'd sort of forgotten what had happened there. You know, these are very frightening, particularly Chernobyl, which was a terrible, terrible accident. But, you know, on the other hand, we live with nuclear power, and, I think the kind of statistic that always comes out, you know, we have 35,000 people dying in traffic accidents every year. We sort of take that, you know, we want the transportation, we want to drive, so we live with that. You know, nuclear power in the United States has been, you know, you look at over the long term, you know, we've really lived with it with reasonable comfort.
Now, other sort of alternatives, we do use hydro as an alternative, which is renewable. Then we look at geothermal and wind and then solar. What are your thoughts, just sort of briefly, on each of those categories?
They're all are very promising, and they all have their cons. You know, I think the with the geothermal and the hydropower, they're sort of geographically limited at the point. You have to be, like in the Pacific Northwest, they do a lot of hydropower because they have the water up there that makes it work. The downside is it certainly does seem to affect the wildlife, and there are a lot of disputes about the dams and how we're going to do that. With geothermal, you know, it's limited now by the geological capability of doing it. They're working on having it be more available, actually digging down and kind of creating the heat within the earth. But, you know, there've been some experiments where they've had kind of tremors, almost kind of earthquake-like tremors emerging from that. So that has to be worked out. With wind and solar, which are, really growing, particularly wind power, really growing. And, I think the tantalizing part of these with wind and solar, if you ever get them up and running, you know, the wind and the sun are free. So, you know, it's really a wonderful kind of vision.
Sure.
You know, the drawbacks now are that they're expensive. With wind and solar right now, they only really operate when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining. And since we expect power all the time, you have to have some sort of backup power. And that could be, you know, nuclear, natural gas. So it's not really ready to operate all the time. We can't store it that well. The transmission system is not set up. I think a lot of people, because it gets so much publicity, you know, right now wind and solar combined is only about 2% of our energy. So, you know, it is that wonderful promise, but it has a long, long way to go, as do, you know, many of these energy questions. It's just very, very complicated, and it needs some persistence. You know, we can't get this all worried one year and then forget about it for the next five, because we really need some persistent attention to changing the energy supply.
It's tough to admit, but a number of other countries have plunged further ahead on changing their energy use than Americans have. Take Denmark. It's a showcase for wind power, spurred by the fact that the Baltic Sea provides a nice, steady wind source, both offshore and on. Now Denmark gets 20% of its electrical capacity from wind. Other European countries, including Germany and Spain, have also invested big in wind power based on Denmark's example. Denmark is certainly proof that wind power can work, but the Danes also have a couple of advantages over the U.S. One is that Denmark is small, so the electricity generated by wind turbines doesn't have to go long distances. The situation is quite different in the U.S., where many of the best locations for wind power tend to be on the Great Plains, well away from the cities that need the electricity. To move that wind electricity to where it's needed, the United States would have to invest in an improved electric grid to the tune of at least $20 billion. The Danes put government incentives behind wind as well.
The trees bend because of the wind along that lonesome border. The trees bend because of the wind all along the line.
Denmark also proves that wind power isn't necessarily cheap. The Danes pay some of the highest electric rates in Europe, about 32 cents a kilowatt hour in 2006, compared to 22 cents in Germany, 14 cents in France, and 10 cents in the United States. In the early 1970s, France chose to do exactly the opposite of the United States. France committed to nuclear power.
Go nuclear!
The British historically relied heavily on coal for both electricity and for home heating. That combination, along with natural fog, helped give London its dark and smoky reputation. In the 1990s, Britain decided to shift away from coal to cleaner natural gas, and that was a big shift. Coal is abundant, it's cheap, and it has a storied history in Britain. In 1990, it provided 65% of the UK's electricity, compared to 1% for natural gas. By 2000, coal was down to 33%, and natural gas was up to 39%.
Who needs a car and a 747 when you can't buy a gallon of gas? Who needs a highway, an airport, or a jet when you can't get a gallon of gas?
We're back with Gene Johnson, author of Who Turned Out the Lights?
There's no more oil left in the well. A gallon of gas can't be purchased anywhere.
Speaking of electricity and storage, is there, you know, short of, you know, big giant batteries, is there anything on the horizon that would alleviate that problem of storage?
Well, you know, I think they are working on the batteries. They haven't solved it yet. That is a big issue. And, you know, I think in the last campaign there was a proposal, you know, to have a prize for that. And, you know, people talk about having something like a Manhattan Project where, you know, you might get the engineers and scientists really working on an issue like that, the storage issue. I think there are a lot of interesting discussions about what would happen with a new smart electric grid where if you had solar panels all over your house and you were generating power, or you could sell it back to the community and they could use it. And, you know, there are lots of very, very interesting ideas. You know, the issue is putting enough of sustained attention on them to do it. And the electric grid, you know, I think that there is probably a consensus. We really need to do some work on that. It's old. It doesn't handle wind and solar very well. And it's going to take a long, long time. It's a big mission to get that redone. We're going to have to do that. So, and that's the transmission system. That's the way we're going to be able to get energy around the country in an efficient way. In some ways, we're not even doing the easy things. You know, there are these kind of minor changes you can make in your house, a caulking in the windows. You know, they add, you know, several thousand dollars to a new house, which you know, I know you buy a house, you're just, you know, giving several thousand dollars to almost everybody that shows up at the door. It's such an expensive project. You know, we have, 78 million houses in the United States. We've only, less than a million have been either renovated or built to these specifications. So we have, 78 million houses to go to even, do the kind of minor things that would make them more energy efficient.
Now, so many of these decisions are long-range decisions, so we're not really doing much right now, frankly.
I think the idea behind the legislation in Congress, cap and trade, which is not the only way to do it, but the idea is that you would make the fossil fuels, the coal and the oil, more expensive so that these wind and solar and nuclear, if that's the way that a state decides to go, have a chance to compete. Some people say that cap and trade is too complicated. We really should tax carbon. That's an easier way to do it. But right now, the economies, coal is the cheapest way to go. And I think, human beings tend to do the cheapest thing. So we are, the economies of energy are kind of fighting what we need to do. The mindset where we just think the issue is the price of gas and we don't really talk about the energy issue is, I think, holding us back. And, I think that there's a very low level of not just concern, which is one thing, but even of knowledge. Our organization, Public Agenda, did a survey last year just looking at knowledge about energy, and 4 out of 10 Americans can't even name a fossil fuel. You wonder how they're following all the debate in Copenhagen and in Washington. Half can't rename a renewable form of energy. Substantial numbers think that if you're addressing pollution in the air, you're tackling global warming. You have to do something different to tackle global warming. We had a surprising number thought that solar energy contributed to global warming. So, we're just so flip on the switch, it's there, we don't know about it. I use myself as an example. I work for a public policy organization. And when we started to work on the book, working with a co-author, Scott Biddle, we kind of split things up, and I started working on natural gas, kind of doing some research, pulling together some work on that. And, the way I started off, living New Yorker, living in an apartment, says, I think maybe it's in the stove, the natural. I knew nothing about this as an energy form. So, we haven't really, don't have really a kind of a fundamental level of education that allows us to think about these issues. We're not going to be experts, but we need to know a little bit about the debates that are going to be happening in our communities, our states, and at the national level.
Yet it seems to me that the pursuit of alternative energy and the technology and the solutions associated with that could really drive our economy for many years into the future.
Well, I think this is what is actually interesting about this debate about what it's going to cost. Because, when we consider something like the cap and trade bill or carbon tax or any of the other ideas out there to kind of push us, ahead on energy, there's a lot of focus on, oh, gosh, it's going to drive up utility costs. It might drive up gas prices. We get very mesmerized by that. And, high energy prices are really tough on low-income families. We need to kind of think about how to handle that. But we get really mesmerized by these short-term costs. And yet, the jeopardy to the country if we don't do anything and we're sort of stuck, using high-priced energy down the road is serious. And second is there's the economic opportunity of the country in developing alternatives and, for this is a country where we do have a lot of good, scientists, engineers, innovators, and, developing these new technologies that are going to work. And, this big debate over clean coal. And this is another classic thing about the pros and cons. There are technologies, you need to work on them, that could allow you to use coal without the global warming. It's not ready for prime time. They're doing little experiments in Norway, and there's one plant in the United States that's kind of working on this. It would require an investment. It would be expensive. It would, keep the innovators and the engineers busy for a long time. On the other side of that, there is a lot of coal all over the world, and if if somebody can figure out how to allow human beings to use this without contributing to global warming, that's going to be a valuable, popular technology. You know, do we want to compete with that and go after that? You know, maybe we do. Other people say, no, we really should. We should put our effort into wind and solar and some other alternatives. So there's sort of priority debates. But there are these economic opportunities we need to think about.
What advice would you give to our listeners about what they can do to move the ball a little bit here?
One of the things is that we really do need to push decision makers nationally to get going. And, you know, the people were very upset about energy last year, a little bit more than last year at this time. You know, now this is, and when you look at the polling, has really dropped as a priority for Congress. So we need, as a public, to kind of put up the pressure and make sure that we are doing our jobs as citizens to push. You know, I think people will come to different conclusions about exactly what solutions they want, but we need to make some decisions. The second thing is, I think this is an issue where so many of the decisions are local and state decisions, where I think we actually have a lot more impact. And, you know, states have to make decisions about how they're going to generate electricity, and people can really get involved in that and, you know, really get involved in the local decisions to try to get their state to plan for the future, not just look at the most convenient thing to do right now.
That's good advice. We've been speaking with Jane Johnson, who with Scott Biddle wrote a book called Who Turned Out the Lights, which is a great read and a very important subject matter. Is there a website or a way to get
in touch? It's whoturnedoutthelights.org. And there's information about the book. We actually have what we call the Fossil Fuel Centerfold. It's not quite as glamorous as
quite
it sounds,
tease.
But it's a little cheat sheet. Kind of goes over different kinds of energy and what some of the pros and cons are, how much we use. And just a little kind of starter kit to start thinking about this issue.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Jane Johnson, co-author of Who Turned Out the Lights. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind.
Podcasts of What's at Risk are available at the WBZ.com on the air drop-down menu by clicking on What's at Risk. You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030 and streaming on WBZ.com.
Run the risk.